The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Hi, before we get started, I just wanted to let you know about a live event we're hosting next Monday, April 22nd in New York City. It's a conversation with the one and only Scott Galloway, NYU business professor, irreverent podcast host, and author of the new book, The Algebra of Wealth, A Simple Formula for Financial Security. If you'd like to join us at BetaWorks in the Meatpacking District to have a cocktail, get a signed book, and hear Scott's intel on how you can boost your bank account, go to nextbigideaclub.com/events and use the code podcast to get a 50% discount. Now on with the show.
LinkedIn presents.
Hi, this is the Next Big Idea Daily. I'm your host, Michael Kavanat, and it's Thursday. So how much do you know about rhetoric? Okay, I guess that was a rhetorical question in more ways than one. But the fact is that until relatively recently, rhetoric, the ancient art of persuasion, was considered a foundation of a Western education. It's rarely taught as a standalone subject in schools anymore, but it's a skill that may be more needed than ever in a world awash in dubious information and heightened political conflict. Here with some guidance is Robin Reams, author of the new book, The Ancient Art of Thinking for Yourself, The Power of Rhetoric in Polarized Times. Robin is an associate professor of English at the University of Illinois at Chicago, specializing in rhetorical theory and the history of ideas. Here she is with some insights from her book.
Hello. You've already heard who I am, so instead of starting off by telling you who I am, I'm going to start off by telling you who I used to be. Before I became a professor of rhetoric, I grew up in a fundamentalist Christian, white, and very conservative family in the Deep South. And the world I grew up in was deeply suspicious of the world out there. Up until about my late adolescence and early adulthood, I more or less believed that the polarized view of the world that dominated my subculture was true. Liberals were bad, conservatives were good. They are the bad guys, we are the good guys. Things started to change for me when I went away to college and eventually began studying rhetoric, the field in which I'm now an expert. Rhetoric ultimately showed me how everything, from disagreements with my parents to the polarized politics of our time, and even to the way that we think about truth itself, is propelled by the power of words. I wrote this book because I believe anyone who learns these concepts and techniques can begin thinking more freely and independently, and even live happier and more fulfilling lives. Rhetoric isn't what you think it is. It's not lies or deception, hot air or bullshit, or maybe you don't think it's anything at all. The number one question I get asked when I tell people what I study is, what's rhetoric? Initially, rhetoric emerged in the ancient Greek world because people needed a tool for understanding how language could be used to wreak so much political havoc. The idea was that by seeing how the tricks of language and persuasion worked, people would be less easily tricked. We begin using rhetoric anytime we take a step back from language and evaluate it with a more critical eye. The field of rhetoric developed over hundreds of years as this vast metalanguage, that is, language about language, words that name and describe what language is, what it can do, how it works, and why it's persuasive. That's rhetoric. To me, the funny thing about the question that I get asked so often, what's rhetoric, is how totally unaskable it would have been at virtually every period of Western history prior to this one. And that's because after its inception in ancient Greece, and for more than 2,000 years, rhetoric dominated education throughout Europe, the Near and the Middle East, North Africa, and eventually even America, up until the beginning of the 20th century. So it's only recently that we stopped paying attention to it. But when we begin paying attention, it alters our perspective on a lot of things, even truth itself. One of the things rhetoricians study is how the very idea of truth has changed over time. not in the sense of what thing or idea or statement is true, but in the sense of what the word truth, as a metalanguage, means, full stop. Today, we think of truth as a correct representation in language. That is, something is true when the words correctly represent the world and false when they don't. But way back at the beginning of the rhetorical tradition, that's not how people thought about truth at all. They thought of truth as something being revealed or undisclosed to them. That was actually the literal meaning of their word for truth, something being unhidden. And the opposite of truth wasn't falsehood, but hiding, in the sense of keeping something hidden from view or just failing to reveal it. In the same way that we're suspicious today of, say, like AI, ancient rhetoricians were suspicious of written speeches because it seemed to them that the speaker was hiding behind written words rather than just speaking openly the words that revealed what they thought, revealed themselves to the audience. So their speech was, in a very real and important sense, untrue when it was written. And believe it or not, we still carry around this ancient notion of truth today. It's actually a major reason we believe speakers and politicians who tell us obvious, bold-faced, even proven lies. When they speak extemporaneously, it naturally seems to us as though they are genuinely revealing something to the audience, rather than hiding behind prefabricated words. In ancient rhetoric, this showing and revealing that happens in spontaneous speaking was as good as true. And to many people today, it's still as good as true, whether or not it should be. Facts don't work the way you think they do either. We tend to think of facts as fixed, immutable, or unchangeable realities of the world. So logically, it would seem to follow that the more factual a speech is, the more convincing it will be. But oddly, when facts are packaged in language, this is not the case at all. In part, this is because for a fact to even be a fact in the first place, it has to be falsifiable. If it doesn't have the potential of at least being proven false, it's not a fact. In rhetorical practice, what this means is that all it takes for a fact to lose its status as a fact in a speech is for someone to contradict it, to come along and knock it down, to say it isn't a fact. All it takes for it to seem like Obama might not have been born in the United States is for someone to deny that he was. Or, for example, for us to believe that the Sandy Hook school shooting, the moon landing, Biden's election, or insert conspiracy theory here, didn't happen. All it takes is for someone to deny that event's factual status. In language, facts work the opposite of how they work in life. And this helps to explain why we have so many outlandish conspiracy theories these days. Fact denial works like a rhetorical snap of a finger every time. The same goes for values. Unlike facts, we think of values as subjective. They're aesthetic, moral, cultural judgments, and also high ideals like freedom, the nation, truth, honor, family, security, and so on and so forth. So we might assume the more persuasion depends on values, the less convincing it's going to be. But oddly, in rhetoric, again, the situation is actually reversed. While speech that relies heavily on facts tends to be quite vulnerable to refutation, speech that relies heavily on values can be very hard, if not impossible, to refute. Values are difficult to refute because they are abstract. They don't have any concrete content of their own. They have to be given concrete content by being applied to a specific situation. The value of, say, freedom doesn't have much independent meaning until it's applied to a specific context where freedom, we're meant to believe, is at stake. This actually means that, believe it or not, we share a lot of values in common. Almost everyone would agree that values like freedom, honor, patriotism, courage, and so on matter. And so it's kind of strange when you think about it, how polarized our politics are and how much we distrust each other, given how many values we share in common. Where we disagree, it's not because we don't share a given value. It's because we're applying values and prioritizing them differently in a specific context. Let me give you an example. During the pandemic, a lot of disagreements about stay-at-home orders, mask mandates, and vaccines were propelled not by science or facts, as we may have thought they were, but by a conflict of values. Liberty versus safety, for example. Or the value of freedom versus health. Or the private individual who gets to do what they want versus prioritizing, say, the public good. These values were a lot more influential on people's responses to the pandemic than science or fact. And in fact, where science or facts entered the arena, it was often because it was being treated as a value. The more one value was treated like an absolute value, not tempered or put in check by another competing value, the more uncompromising and extreme a person's response was likely to be. Often, our most entrenched disagreements these days stem from the fact that we treat issues as though one value and one value only is all that matters. We can begin to understand each other better when we try to understand how the values we share, rather than one and only one absolute value, are mutually at stake in the issues we confront as a society. We can learn to disagree better by asking better questions. Now, this is a skill we have almost entirely lost today, but it was an entire method in its own right in ancient rhetoric. Today, instead of asking questions, we take stands, almost reflexively or automatically. And our stance on, say, Gaza versus Israel, or Black Lives Matter versus the police, Ukraine versus Russia, Trump versus Biden, is typically determined automatically and before the fact by what side we're on. Whether we know it or not, we inherit this idea of taking a stand in political disagreements from the ancient Greeks. They called it stasis, which literally meant stand in Greek. But unlike us today, the ancient rhetoricians didn't begin with a stance. They asked a series of what they called stasis questions to arrive at a stance. They believed there were really only four possible kinds of disagreements that people could have, and therefore only four kinds of stasis questions to ask. Number one, the question of fact. Does a problem even exist? If a problem exists, then they ask question number two, definition. Well, then what kind of problem is it? If a problem exists and they know what kind of problem it is, then they ask number three, quality. How serious or intense is the problem? How harmful is it in terms of its effects? And only once they've determined the answers to these questions do they finally ask the fourth question, policy. What should be done about it? Debates that were not in stasis hadn't yet figured out precisely which issue their disagreement fell under. And if not put in stasis, the two sides would simply just be talking past each other with no hope of a resolution. One of the reasons we talk past each other these days in public debates stems from the fact that all or nearly all of our stances focus on policy. That's question number four. When our disagreements are actually rooted in another question, fact, question number one. And the funny thing about the fact question is how flexible it is. The ancient Roman philosopher and statesman Cicero was one of the first people to point out how very malleable and not self-evident the fact question can be. Because for one thing, as Cicero put it, it can be assigned to any time. Everything from did Ulysses kill Ajax to if we leave Carthage untouched, will any harm come to the Roman state counts as a question of fact. So this means that experimenting with the fact question can take a debate in new directions, and even with debates that seem totally irreconcilable and entrenched. Take the border as an example. We go back and forth endlessly over building a border wall, increasing or decreasing policing the border, increasing or decreasing apprehensions or expulsions, changing or reinforcing amnesty requirements, and so on and so forth. All of these are policy positions. But do we ask any questions of fact? Here are only a few fact questions that we don't ask. Do current border policing practices decrease border crossing attempts? Would a more strongly defended border improve the conditions of poverty that migrants are attempting to escape? Would a border wall erode foreign relations with allies to the south? Is there a problem with valuing security over life? Is there a problem with valuing life over security? These are only a handful of the fact questions we might begin asking on only one of the issues where we're so divided. Depending on which fact questions we ask, not only do our answers vary, And not only do we discover some questions we might answer the same way, even with people whose views we dispute, but our attention also focuses on different aspects of the problem, aspects that might be less irreconcilable than we think, aspects we might not have thought about by simply taking a stand on policy, one position after another after another. And this is only the tip of the iceberg. There are countless other ways that the ancient art of rhetoric can help you begin to think differently, to think for yourself in this intensely polarized age.
Okay, well, I hope you found Robin's ideas on rhetoric persuasive, because, you know, persuasive writing and speaking is kind of her thing. Now, let me see if I can persuade you to sign up for my newsletter. It's a companion to this podcast and a free weekly roundup of the latest ideas in nonfiction. To sign up, use the link in the episode notes or search for The Next Big Idea on LinkedIn. And come on back tomorrow when we'll hear from Will Cady, the author of Which Way is North? A Creative Compass for Makers, Marketers, and Mystics. I'm Michael Kovnat. See you tomorrow.